you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Gully. And joining us this month to talk about Limited Collector's Edition C-39 Secret Origins Supervillains, no of there, is our pal, Dr. Jennifer Schwartz-Levine. Hi, Jen.
Hello, how are you? It's wonderful to talk to you.
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for coming back onto one of my shows. You and I recorded together a couple of years ago on For All Mankind, where we talked about my single favorite issue of that series, number 28. And I've always wanted, you've been on other shows on the network, and I've always wanted to have you back on. And I realized, hey, we're running out of time here on Treasury Cast, so I had to make sure I get you on. So again, we're here to talk about the Secret Origins Supervillains. Again, there should be an of there, but there isn't. If you look at the cover, it just says Secret Origins Supervillains. So we're going to talk about the stories contained in this book. But of course, since you have not been on the show before, I need to ask you, what, if any, history do you have with this particular Treasury format?
Very little. I mean, I've seen them before, I've looked at them before, but, you know, sort of doing a deep dive or reading them or going through them the way that you have and collecting them, I have not. I do have an actual physical copy of Secret Origins Supervillains.
Oh.
Well, when you contacted me about this and you sent me files, but my husband went and tracked it down and because he's like, well, we don't have that one. So I'm holding it in my hands right here, right now. And I love the fact that it's oversized. I love what the cover promised me is going to come, but was not fulfilled. But I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute.
Well, first of all, awesome job of husbanding.
Yes.
Right? Good job.
Yes,
excellent.
Tim's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I know your history. You guys are comic nerds together. So that's just absolutely fantastic. May I ask where he got it? Did he get it at a comic store or did he just go on eBay and get it?
I think he went to eBay land.
Okay. All right. So I hope that he found, because they can run pretty expensive, you know, depending on which one it is. So I hope that he found it at a reasonable price.
Yeah, I do remember that he said that he got it and it was not ridiculously expensive. So it was reasonably priced. So, but yeah, no, I love it. And, you know, I love the fact that it's that oversized format and they're a lot of fun.
Do you have a place to store this book now that you own it?
Yes. Yes, we do. So,
okay.
So it will be joining the collection, you know, because there's a special section in the comics books room for oversized things.
Perfect. So, perfect. I mean, if you have any of like the absolute editions or anything, they fit.
Yeah,
it'll fit right into that. I mean, that was part of the thing that killed the treasuries was as the fans, the diehard fans became more and more the base of the sales. They didn't like these books because you couldn't store them. There are no bags, at least at the time, there were no bags and boards and they were easily damaged. And so that's why people were like, oh, no, you know, forget it. I don't want to hold these. But I'm glad. How many comics do you guys have in your collection by this point, by the way?
Well, he is actually doing the annual sort right now where he it is this whole, you know, every year it's the bags up and adds to the database, you know, all the comics that we've read over the course of the past year. We are at, last I heard, right around 30,000 issues.
Plus,
we've got trades and, you know, I mean, you know, collections and all of that. So, but when we bought our house, our realtor, I think, thought that we were insane because, you know, we didn't have sort of a style of house that we were looking for. We had a general area where we wanted to live in between our two workplaces, but we're like, listen, we got to have room for the comics. And at the time I had a blind cat. So I'm like, so we got to make it so that Harriet doesn't fall off things, but we have to have places where we can store the comics and access them and use them. So I don't think that our realtor had ever had that request before, but here we are.
30,000.
Yeah,
That it's oh, I did not expect. I knew it'd be a lot, but I didn't know
it's
it'd
a
be.
lot. Well, Tim has been collecting since he was an 11-year-old boy in the summer of 1989. So that's how things got started, was with the Batman movie, and here we are all these years later. So
Unbelievable. You mentioned your blind cat, and yes, you of course you have to, you know, the cat has to navigate around the
Yes.
comics. I
Yes.
think I've mentioned on the show previously, my collection of treasuries has always been sitting on the bottom shelf of a bookcase. And not too long after I adopted my cat, Frankie, 10 years ago or 12 years ago at this point, she decided to sharpen her claws on the spines of
Oh
all of my treasuries.
no. Oh
And
no.
yeah, and you know, the context, the reason I'm even getting into this, that is how much I loved my cat, is that I did not get
Yes.
rid of her for
Yes.
that, because
Yes.
I came home and watched her as she was shredding the staples out of Best of DC
Oh.
number 52. I was like, and
Well, she had good taste in reading material.
she did. She could not resist. And so actually just today I was pulling out some other books and I was like, wow, she really shredded some of these. Some of these are really rough. So I was just like, but I was like, Frankie, you have no idea how close you came, my dear. But okay. So yeah. So well, that's awesome. I'm so excited that you have the actual physical copy to look at, because there are some things worth noting about some of these treasuries. The fact that they're oversized doesn't really factor into our conversation because it just doesn't really matter. But there's some moments here that I think are worth commenting on in terms of seeing it in the book. I'm so thrilled that you're getting to see it at the size that I did
Yes.
when I bought this book. By the way, this issue came out on July 3rd, 1975, so
Wow.
right before Independence Day, and the cover is by Dick Giordano, and we've got a bunch of the DC heroes: Superman, Batman, Flash. As he's mentioned on the cover, Shazam, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman, and then squaring off, running on the other side of the book, the cover is Luthor, Joker, Captain Cold, Savannah, Sinestro, and Cheetah. And as I mentioned to you on our episode of For All Mankind, because that cover features the superheroes, super friends versus the monsters, I am a sucker for the heroes on one side of the cover and the villains on the other side, and them charging each other. I am like guaranteed sales, because that just always works for me. So.
No, I love this, and I love, sort of the way that it sort of uses the space on the cover, and the perspective and all of it. I mean, this is just, it's a terrific cover.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, right? Poor Dick Giordano had to draw what, like 12 figures on the cover. You know, he was a workhorse, and it lists all their names, as I mentioned. Now, as you mentioned, not all these characters will be appearing in this book. Some of them
No.
will make sort of cameo appearances, but of course, there's only room for a couple of only five stories here. So, right off the bat, is one of the things I wanted to mention in terms of the treasury size is that these stories feature little interstitial pages of the villains introducing their origin.
Yes.
And so, the opening page, you've got this Carmen Infantino, Murphy Anderson shot of the Joker. That's a very iconic shot of the character. You've seen him on very he th this shot of the Joker goes so far as to appear in the 1983 music video by Bob Dylan, Joker Man, and that's it features it's even featured in that. That's how far this kind of made it into the general popular culture. But we've got the Joker introducing his story, but it's odd in that he's in front of this kind of nothing background, which really seems odd when you look again at the treasures. You're like, really? They couldn't have drawn something in the background here? It looks like they just kind of threw it together, to be honest.
Because I was thinking, because it's evocative of like a playing card, and given some of what comes after that, I'm surprised they didn't do something with that.
Yeah. We again, this is something that's come up on this show, on other shows on the network, on other comic book podcasts, is that especially in the 70s, pretty much all the way through into the 80s, I would say, but especially in the 70s, Marvel was just so much better at really kind of making sure that everything that they gave you was sort of like iconic and character driven, and DC kind of threw stuff together at the time. So, you know, Marvel, just last month, actually, we were talking about the greatest superhero team ups, and those have interstitial little pinups, and they've got the logo for the character, and they've got backgrounds, and they look like there's stuff that you could just print on a t-shirt. And DC was just like, Just put Joker in front of a kind of some squares. That's good. You know, it's fine. Yeah, yeah. Whatever. So, so the first story is The Man Behind the Red Hood. It's from Detective Comics number 168. It's by Bill Finger, Lou Schwartz, and George Russos. Now, I'm not going to be doing detailed plot synopses because those are boring to write and they're boring to read. And I just don't want to waste time going through the plot details of this other than a very, you know, great, large 30-foot, 1,000 level, as Shag likes to say. Basically, this is the origin, as we will learn at the end of the story, as everyone knows, the origin of the Joker. But the setup is Batman is teaching this sort of crime solvers course to a bunch of students. And there's this character named the Red Hood, and they get involved in that story. And it's this kind of like teaching the kids how to be detectives. And there's all little clues. And then we find that there's this guy, the Red Hood, causing crimes. And then at the end, we learn who is under the Red Hood this whole time. It's the Joker. And the Joker, and like in basically the last two panels of the story, reveals what happened to him, which is like, it's amazing how kind of tossed off that moment is when you consider how legendary it's become in the popular culture is this thing. But I want to ask, what did you think of this story?
Yeah, that was kind of my take as well, because I thought, well, and I mean, I've seen this in other places before. And what surprised me was this thing that has become so legendary, so iconic, so associated with this is how the Joker came to be. I mean, and I mean, look at how many times it's been reused in other places, you know, when we've talked about the Joker's origin. And it's basically 2-3 panels. And that blew my mind. So, but the other thing that I thought was amused me, and probably only me, because, you know, I'm a college professor, you know what I do for a living. Mm-hmm. That whole thing about the dean hiring Batman to teach criminology, but this is not how you hire adjunct faculty. You know, this is not how you do it. And I just love how he is teaching the class. You know, obviously he cannot do it as Bruce Wayne, but I love how Batman is there teaching the class in full bat garb as he's teaching them how to be detectives. So
I was relieved. One of the students is Hawaiian.
Yes.
And you have to judge things in the times they were made, and you can't, you have to kind of look at it from, you know, that perspective. I will say though, there are times when you're reading old comics, right? And mm-hmm. they introduce a character who is not white, and you kind of brace a little because you're like,
I did exactly the same thing.
Right. But in this case, they don't do that. Like the Hawaiian character, like they don't introduce any sort of real clumsy stereotype. He is just as agile and smart as the rest of the students, and he happens to be from Hawaii, and he happens to be sort of colored a little differently. But I was so happy that there wasn't any other thing that I had to kind of just blow past in the story.
I too was relieved, because when I started to read this, I'm like, oh my, here we go. But I am grateful that it turned out to be that you know, and he was, you know, sort of the one of the top students in the class.
Yeah.
That, you know, he and his compatriot, Jimmy Cale, you know, sort of worked together to solve a good chunk of the crime. I mean, it wasn't sensitive considering the era. It was just sort of appropriate depictions of, you know, college students.
Yeah. Right, yeah, exactly. They're all in their kind of like college sweaters and stuff.
Yes,
I do love the last panel when he's like, Joker says, in all these years I've been laughing at you, haha, you'll never even know my identity till now. You're wrong, Joker. I knew your identity before we opened the shack. Robin and a green hair can vouch for that. So you see, the joke's been on you all along. And then Robin, haha, that's right. Now it's our turn to laugh, haha. You guys are talking to a multiple murderer, right? It's not that funny.
Well, yeah, but we ignore the multiple murderer part.
Right. This is in the Detective 168 is the late 40s, I believe. So it's just he's coming out of that era where he's the murderer, and then he's moving into the funny, more clown era because they had to kind of ramp the violence down a little. But
it was what, 51? Was it February 51? Is that the
51? Yeah, so it's not late 40s. Yeah. It's actually very early, really early 50s.
Yeah.
But yeah, it said we talked about this on the episode I did with Gabriel Hardman, where we discussed Famous First Edition Flash Comics #1, where like that single comic has the debuts of the Flash and Hawkman and Johnny Thunder, and you're like, just this one book became one of the the pillars of a empire now, of a company that's owned by Warner Brothers, and it is worth, you know, how many hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars. And so, yeah, this last page, you're wondering if Bill Finger was almost like, oh yeah, I guess, yeah, okay. Then he goes into the chemicals. That's cool. Like, he probably wrote it in an afternoon. And you're like, if you could go back in time and say, do you realize what you're writing now will become world famous? There will be children who have never read a Batman comic who will be able to tell you what the Joker's basic origin is. That would be, I think to him, he'd be like, what are you talking about? What? And yet here it is. It's like for all eternity.
Yes. And again, like I said, my first time through it, I'm like, this is so iconic. This is so definitive of the Joker, of Batman, of Robin, of the entire mythos that, you know, sort of the you know, ongoing war that they had between them. And it's like three panels. So yeah. it's crazy.
They had like nine other stories to get to, right? For 10 yeah, cents. Right. They had nine other things. We got to get to Word Raymond TV Detective. So, okay. Next up is How Luthor Met Superboy. We all know how that's going to go. It's from Adventure Comics number 271. It's by Jerry Siegel and Al Plastino. So once again, you've got this interstitial of Luthor in profile, just standing ramrod straight. I don't understand why he's like, why they draw him doing something. Just standing there.
Well, and that's the case for almost all of these, because that was the thing that as I was reading through them, I'm like, well, almost all of them are static. They don't move. And I'm like, could you not draw a background? Were we on deadline? What happened? You know, because I mean, Luthor gets, as opposed to the square that the Joker got, the Luthor gets a circle. So mm-hmm. I mean, are we doing basic shapes? What are we doing?
There's a parallelogram behind Savannah. What's going to happen here? Yeah. It's just the fact that he's standing there just very stiffly is like they clearly just statted that out of a panel.
Oh, absolutely.
And threw it in there. And I'm like, you know, it's just to me, it's like DC, don't ever change. You know, DC of the 1970s, right. just be what you are. So, of course, again, everyone knows the story here where young Lex Luthor befriends Superboy. He helps rescue him. And when he gets Superboy gets hit by some kryptonite, Luthor. And so, you know, boy Lex Luthor wants to help Superboy. He wants to, you know, help him become a more powerful superhero and rescue him, stuff like that. There is and so he's tinkering with all these chemicals. He tries to come up with a kryptonite sort of antidote. Art wise by Al Plastino, I'd love to know what you think about the style. I love the little cloud creature that he creates out of his test tube. That is wonderfully drawn. It's got this, it's like a smog monster. It looks really, really cool.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, I like the hands on him as well. I mean, as he's kind of coming up out of the flask. I mean, it's delightful is what it is. And that actually in some ways is one of my favorite parts of this, because, you know, as you sort of see what's happening to the creature that that has been created, you know, there's liveliness and movement to that in ways that for a lot of the other things there aren't.
Yeah. This is great. Al Plastino, it's really very smooth and kind of got a lot of motion to it. And just that little smog monster has such life and when he's only in a couple of panels. So anyway, of course, there's a fire. Superboy tries to blow out the fire. He sprays the chemicals on Luthor, which causes him to go bald. And it causes Luthor to go instant heel turn. I mean, within 5 minutes. He goes from, I love you, Superboy, to, I am now going to destroy you. I'm like, look, as someone who has been shaving his head for 20 years, it's not that big a deal. It's really okay. I mean, I'm like, jeez, Luthor. Oh my God.
I know. But yeah, it is. It's this crazy thing. I mean, as I was making notes about things, I thought he's almost, his adoration of Superboy, it's like with the shrine that he's got going there. I mean, it's almost stalkery.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden, one lab accident, you lose your hair, and then it becomes sort of like this, you know, sort of twisted vengeance that he's, you know, Superboy has not returned his love in the appropriate way. It gets a little weird.
Yep. And kind of similar to the Joker story in that's the famous moment. That's the moment I knew as a kid. I knew it from the Challenge of the Super Friends cartoon because they talk about it there. And it's like you would think, oh, that's the story. Well, no, the story keeps going after. Like, again, this really iconic moment in the history of Superman Luthor is two pages. out of like a 12-page story. They've got something. So it continues on, and Luthor pretends to be like, oh, no, I'm actually not so mad. And he's using it as a trap to lure Superboy. They actually go into space, where he tries to lure Superboy into this sort of kryptonite asteroid field. Crypto senses it and manages to stay away. I mean, it's like, I love the dog having.
I love the drawings of Crypto here. Like when Crypto's flying out, like his little tongue's out of his mouth as he's escaping. That is, I think, one of my favorite panels in this whole thing.
Yeah. And then finally, Luthor lures Superboy back into his vault, and he lets this kryptonite trap, but Superboy kind of already knew of it, and he sort of prepared for that, so he kind of does like a doubles back on Luthor, and it ends with Superboy flying away saying, "Strange, I just realized that Lex Luthor has the same initials as Lana Lang. LL, will Luthor become a great scientist or a criminal?" And I think the answer to that is, if you look right behind you, Superboy, Luthor is waving his fist at you angrily.
I know. And I mean, I think in some ways the answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
I mean, but the other thing is that we have had no Lana all the way through here. And then all of a sudden it's like, by the way, they have the same initials. I mean, it's completely apropos of nothing.
Poor Lori Lamaris doesn't even get a mention then. I mean, what are we doing here? So, Now I want to ask you, this is something Shag and I have talked about on Fire and War and other shows, is like, by Shag's own admission, he cannot really tolerate Golden Age or early Silver Age stories. Like, the storytelling is just not his area. And so he just has a real tough time getting through them. Where are you on that? I mean, because now we're talking about kind of, you know, very tail end Golden Age, and then the Superboy story is squarely Silver Age. You have to go at these with a certain acceptance of storytelling tropes that nowadays make these stories look, you know, very, very dated, or just at least very, very different than what you're used to. How are you on those? Can you just zip through those and it doesn't bother you?
I mean, obviously I prefer the more modern stuff as a modern reader. But that being said, I have an appreciation for a lot of the early things because there's so much of what's happening in the modern things that are rooted. I mean, like you said, there's these classic, it's two or three panels, but it's like, oh, that's where it first appeared. That's where the origin is. And yes, I will admit some of these were dragged a little in spots. I was highly amused, like when Superboy first spots Lex on his tractor, and he's like, you know, that must be him, that curly haired youth driving that tractor. I'd like to get acquainted. I mean, it's hilarious because it's so dated to me, you know, because that's the way you make new friends when you're a teenage boy. But I appreciate them in some ways because they're dated, because I like to see where things started.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you get Secret Origins, yeah, Super Bowl,
exactly,
right there.
Exactly, right.
So, okay. Well, the next story, we're moving a little further up into the DC timeline. This is The Coldest Man on Earth. It is from Showcase number 8, and it is by John Broome, Carmen Infantino, and Frank Giacoya. And the interstitial here is a little better. It's Captain Cold, kind of. He's getting his freeze gun out of his holster. So he's kind of in the middle of an action. Obviously, he was probably getting the drop on the Flash and whatever cover it's from. But it's got a little more pizzazz than the Luthor one, at least.
Yeah, it does. And it's got a different shape behind it. Is it concave, convex? I can never keep my lens shape straight. So, you know, but it is. And I like this one a little bit better because, again, there is not a bunch of movement, but some. He's mid-action.
Now, this story, his origin could not be, I mean, there's more to the story than this, but his origin is basically, I'm a criminal. I need a gimmick. Oh, how about a cold gimmick? There we go. That's basically the origin of Captain Cold. There's no, he's not like an ice cream vendor, or, you know, he's from Antarctica. It literally is. He's just like, well, what could I do? I guess I could do mirrors. No, that's taken. All right, how about Captain Cold? Good. There we go. I was like, wow, that's it. Yeah. That's all it took.
I know. I'm reading this article in a newspaper one day. I'll be Captain Cold. Let me break into the magazine office to get the research. I mean, that's it.
Yeah, that's all it took. Yeah. And the people's motivations were just so much simpler back then. Now, in the middle of this story, oh, by the way, there is one section before we get to the pinup of the book. There is this great moment where he decides what name he's going to be.
Yes.
And there's,
yes.
He's like, as a series of names rockets through the bizarre villain's mind. And his choices are Mr. Arctic, the Cold Wave, Sub-Zero, and Human Icicle. And then he says, wait, I have it. I'll call myself Captain Cold. Now, obviously, Captain Cold is the name to go with because you've got the alliteration.
Right,
it's very memorable. Right. But I'm kind of a fan of Sub-Zero. I actually think that would have been pretty snazzy.
I actually like that a lot too. I, you know, that probably would have been a very close runner up, but I think the alliteration wins the day.
Yeah. Now, I mean, Mr. Freeze's original name was Mr. Zero. So I guess they both great minds think alike, but I like Mr. Arctic. No, to move off that one. That's a terrible name. So bonus feature wise, in the center of the book is a 2-page pinup. You know, they called them that as if you were going to yank this out of your book and pin it up on your wall. But it was a rogues gallery of supervillains. And it is once again drawn by Dick Giordano. And it has got, and there's a key on the back page of it explaining who all the villains are. Now, some of this is clearly pasted up from other sources, because some of the poses just do not match, kind of like the Mr. McPitalik. He's kind of posing, he's kind of pointing at the penguin's crotch for some reason. But so you've got Joe, I can't list them all, but it's basically these are Superman, Shazam, Flash, and Batman villains. And that's kind of it. You really don't get anybody. It's, you know, there's Luthor and there's Ra's al Ghul and Black Adam, the Scarecrow, Mr. Element, everyone's favorite Mr. Element. Mm-hmm. You've got Captain Boomerang and Savannah and stuff like that. So what did you, this is something that, of course, original to the book. So you would have been seeing this for the first time. What did you think of this little bonus feature?
I actually really loved it. And I was grateful there was a key as well, because while I recognized a good chunk of them, I mean, I looked at a couple of them like, who is King Kull? I mean, that one, I'm like, I don't know offhand who that one is. But I liked it a lot. But yeah, you're right. It's obviously some of these things got pulled from other places and dropped into place, because the pointing at the penguin's area was kind of a dead giveaway. So, but yeah, I like this a lot. And I was kind of surprised as I'm sort of in the middle of the, you know, reading the Captain Cold thing. I'm like, oh, that's cool.
No,
I like
pun intended.
The whole rogue, exactly. That there's the rogue gallery right there. And of course, I like that Catwoman's right there front and center.
Mm-hmm. I love, I learned this. Number 23, IBAC, is really Stinky Print Whistle, who was given the power to become a superpowered villain by saying, IBAC, the powers come from Ivan the Terrible, Borgia, Attila, and Caligula.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, you know, if you're going to pick some historic bad guys, those are some excellent choices.
I don't think we want IBAC, a villain in a kid's comic, to be emulating Caligula in any way.
Anyway,
I saw that movie. No. So,
I like that he's Stinky Print Whistle. That was the other thing that really amused me about this, as I was looking at the key and I'm like, oh, okay. Stinky Print Whistle it is.
If that was my name, I'd become a supervillain as well.
Exactly.
Now, so art-wise, I think the you know, as much as I liked Al Plastino's work I just mentioned in the Superboy segment, I don't think it particularly benefits or is hindered one way or the other from the larger size. I think it looks probably just as good at smaller sizes. His ink line was very smooth. I don't know if in the detective segment, Lou Schwartz and George Russo's work, you know, really benefits from seeing it that bigger, because it's pretty rough. But here, the Infantino Giacoya stuff, I think looks fantastic at this bigger. There's this great panel where the Captain Cold can create mirages using his cold gun, which makes no sense to me. Why does he call himself Captain Mirage?
Using logic. Stop that.
There we go. But he creates these giant staircases to come at the Flash.
Yes.
And it's a marvelous panel. It looks really, really dynamic.
I loved that. That's one of my favorite panels in this particular section, because it's the staircases, the way that they're coming at him, the way that this Flash is in the middle and just looking at them and not able to sort of make sense of why he's seeing all these multiple staircases. And I really loved the panel with the weird animals as well, and also one with the buzzsaw. I thought the buzzsaw one was just terrific.
Yeah. The I mean, it's real students of the – did you read The Flash growing up? Was that one of your favorites?
No, I actually grew up in a town that they finally got a stoplight after I left for college.
Wow.
So,
okay.
yeah, it was – my comics were procured when I could get them when we went to the grocery store or the drugstore, so there was no consistency.
Gotcha. So, gotcha. Yeah, I never read The Flash consistently, and so maybe real students of the Flash series will disagree with this, but I read these early issues because this is Showcase number 8, right? So this is four issues into the Flash's existence. This is not even before he even gets his own book, and right. I'm like, wow! Like, first of all, the work by Infantino, it's Infantino at the top of his game, right? Yeah. And it's, you're like, wow, they really had the Flash strip from the get go. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, this is really solid. It's really fun. It's got some, you know, sci-fi razzmatazz to it. And it's like, it wasn't like these other features that probably took a little while to kind of get up to the level that we think of them as. And like, no, man, they had Flash from kind of like the first issue and boom, you know, hit the ground running, as it were. And that's kind of impressive because it's as much as I like the Superboy one and I like the Detective one, the leap creatively is immense to this issue.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, you know, sort of we've got this, you know, I mean, we've immediately got the ring with the suit. And the, I mean, it's all right there, right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I love this. And I think that this is really one of the best done pieces in the book.
It's kind of amazing to think that the Flash never got his own Treasury edition. You would think there would be, you know, he was always popular. He always had his own book. He was a staple of the Justice League, and unlike even Green Lantern or Aquaman, whose books got canceled sometimes or got, you know, rejiggered to kind of boost sales, Flash was always very consistent, and yet he never got his own Treasury. It seems so strange to me. It seems like a natural, how much material you would have, but no.
Yeah.
So, okay, next up is Savannah. Now, this is probably the best one, right, of the interstitials, because you've got little Savannah, and he's waving his hand, you know, and in the background is a lightning bolt. Perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is definitely the best interstitial. The story that follows has got some problems, but yeah, that's the best interstitial. So.
That's kind. The story is called The Origin of Savannah. It's from Wiz Comics number 15. It's by Bill Parker and C.C. Beck. Now, this is part of the reason why I don't want to do these synopses anymore, because the Captain Marvel stories are just nuts. They're just like, things just happen. And there's the whole, for most people probably, you know, are familiar with Savannah. They know he's the evil scientist version of, you know, kind of he's the Luthor of the Shazam universe. But there's a whole part to his origin where he has all these inventions and he's this genius, but everyone rejects him because he looks funny and he's kind of nasty. And so he decides to pack up and move to another planet. Mm-hmm. And he becomes the ruler of that planet and then comes back to Earth with all of these creatures that he's created. And you're like, when I got to that point, having not read this comic in 30 years, I was like, wait, what?
You want Gloppo a giant frog for pet. I know it. So, yeah, this one was just completely bizarre. And then there was also the issues with the way that the lettering is done, as we're sort of representing Savannah and his Asian heritage.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's a lot of problems here with
when
that.
He dresses like Fu Manchu, it's like,
Chu, yes,
oh boy,
yes,
oh boy,
yeah, exactly, yeah,
yeah. And yet Shazam was like more popular than Superman at a certain point his run.
I know, but the things that we were worried about in the Joker story actually happened in this one. I mean, there's a whole big yellow peril overtone in this entire issue, and oh my, it was that made it kind of tough to read.
Yeah, the thing I can sort of, I guess, appreciate the more I read these Shazam stories because they're good. He got a lot of Treasury editions because DC had just bought the character. They were like really high on this thing, and they were like, hey, we spent money on this, we're gonna really give him a big push. So he got like three treasury editions all to himself. Flash gets zero, Shazam got three. Plus he's appearing in this. But like when I read this story, yes, aside from that stuff, and like again, like the style of lettering where it's literally looks like it's, you know, like kind of like a bamboo sort of, it's really rough stuff. But the craziness of it, the heedless, the no sense.
Bonkers.
I can almost see, like, you know what? I guess if you were a kid and this was your, like, you liked comic book superheroes, why not go for this? Because you could literally be like, I have no idea what's going to happen in these next nine pages. Literally anything there. I mean, we're going to go to another planet. We're going to have monsters. There's a giant, as you mentioned, there's a giant frog that runs around. Like, it's just stuff just happens. And I would imagine if you're into this, you're like, yeah, why not just go all out and live in this crazy world that has zero rules? Zero.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I suppose if you're a kid, that would be absolutely appealing, because if your world is governed by rules, because, you know, your parents have set your bedtime for you, living in a place where there are no rules is going to be something that is intriguing. But this thing is from start to finish completely bonkers.
Yeah. It also, I had forgotten, again, when I read these old stories, like Billy Batson is most of it. Like, it's really about Billy. And then once in a while, Captain Marvel shows up and throws somebody around. You're like, I don't know about you, but like when I was a kid, I didn't want to read about kids. I wanted to read about adults.
No.
So like,
no, exactly.
I was like, why are we spending so much time with Billy Batson? Give me Shazam. Give me Captain Marvel. Right. What are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, but it is. I was surprised by the proportion of it that was Billy. And in some ways, it's Billy that, you know, is the one that when they're out at dinner, that he changes back to Billy from Captain Marvel to, you know, save Beauty and get her out of there before we start the being captured by Savannah.
Oh, that's that's another thing that's has not aged super well, is that Savannah has four children.
Right.
Two of them look like he does, with the really, you know, big buck teeth and kind of gnome like, and then he has two other children that are like, their literal names are like Beautia. They look like an Aryan dream.
Yes.
And the whole gist of that is the ugly ones are evil and the pretty ones are not evil. And I'm like, whoa, there is a whole bunch of eugenic thoughts going on in here.
There absolutely are, which made this a tough go in spots, but you know, but there were also parts of it, like I said, the giant frogs were delightful. So it's an odd combination of things happening in this particular one.
Yeah, even as a kid, when I was first introduced to that concept, I was like, huh, I don't know. I don't know if it's nice to say that the ugly ones are evil. I don't know if that's super, super great, but okay. Mm-hmm. and so our final origin, of course, you know, we're talking about, yes, see, she's laughing already. We're talking about Joker, Lex Luthor, Captain Cold, Savannah, the iconic villains of these heroes. Who do we end the book with? Of course, I'm talking about Terra Man. In the origin of Terra Man from Superman number 249 is by Kerry Bates and the Dynamite team, art team of Dick Dillon and Neil Adams. Now, okay, Terra Man had just been created. He's only a couple of years old. So I'm guessing that that was their, DC was like, hey, we want to give this guy a push. So let's put him in the book. As kind of like, you know, by putting him in a book with Luthor and Savannah and Joker, you're kind of equating him at that level, even though he's not on the cover, right? He's not represented on the cover. The interstitial is actually really good. It's actually a sort of in continuity shot of him in outer space on his flying winged horse and his winged horse.
Yeah. Yeah. Now this is the one that was the best interstitial, but as I was reading this, because at first, when I looked at the cover, I'm like, all right, I'm going to get like a Wonder Woman story. And then I looked at the table of contents and I'm like, Terra Man? What do you mean, Terra Man? Where is my Wonder Woman story? And it was there is none. But yeah, I don't, and it's not like Terra Man has become a, you know, juggernaut of the supervillain pantheon. I mean, it's not like he's around very much now, but you get his origin. And it's silly all the way around.
I mean, maybe he shows up in the James Gunn movie. I don't know. We don't know what's going to happen, you know? But yeah, this story is as goofy in its own way as the Savannah story. Again, the quick origin of Terror Man is we meet him as a young boy. They're living in the Old West, and he's with his dad, who is kind of this sort of cowpuncher and bank robber kind of guy. He steals from a stagecoach, and all of a sudden, a spaceship shows up because, sure, why not? And it tries to steal the coins that this guy has stolen. We see that it's an alien. The alien kills the dad, right? He kills him, and he then, the alien doesn't realize it. He didn't mean to do it. He feels so bad that he takes the kid, kind of like Star-Lord from Guardians of the Galaxy, takes him, brainwashes him so he forgets that he did that. So that way the kid can just live a quote-unquote normal life. He trains the kid as the kid grows up. He trains him to become this sort of outer space outlaw. And he ropes a winged horse, and he becomes this sort of intergalactic cowboy where he steals from people. And then you learn that the brainwashing didn't work at all. He knew it the whole time. In fact, the father had left a clue for him what happened, and he was just waiting all that time to get revenge, and he kills the alien in the final page of the story.
Yeah, this whole thing, it was perplexing. I thought maybe they went with this because they wanted a Western-themed thing, and you feel bad for the little kid, but then he turns out to be, you know, this grown up that has been, of course, molded into this thief. But at the same time, there's no redemption to him in any way.
No,
I mean, some of the other villains, some of the other villains, you understand how they became what they became. There's none of that here.
Right. Look, they only had 7 pages. I mean, they got a lot to get done.
But at least there's a winged horse.
Stuff happens because it does. That's just the way the Terror Man story works. And so, like I said, I think it's because he was a new creation, and they just thought, let's give him a little bit of a boost. And then on the inside back cover, they kind of do some throwaway text origins featuring, finally, Jen, Wonder Woman. Talking about the cheetah, we get Green Lantern and Sinestro, Hawkman and the Shadow Thief, and the Atom and Kronos. As an Aquaman fan, I have to say this feels a real slap in the face that Aquaman doesn't even rate a couple of paragraphs on the inside cover. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know. Now, I mean, and as I said, as upset as I was about Wonder Woman and the cheetah, I thought, you know, you don't even get Aquaman. So at least I got a paragraph.
Yeah, there you go. And then on the back cover, we have our tabletop diorama. As again, we've mentioned on many of these episodes. I'm going to warn you, Jen, in case you're tempted, do not try and make this yourself because they are impossible. The cover stock is just completely works against you as trying to cut it out and make little dioramas. Just please don't ruin your comics.
Oh, no. I mean, I wouldn't do that anyway, but, you know, if we had 2, we might try it, but we've only got the 1.
Yeah, I've tried to do it, and they're brutal. You mess them up, and you just end up being angry, and then your comic is marred for life. So okay. Now that you've read it, you've read your first Treasury, what was your overall feeling of this as a collection of Secret Origins? Do you feel like it holds up as a sort of complete piece, or do you feel like maybe it needed maybe not so much Terror Man and racist Savannah stories and more Wonder Woman and Green Lantern? I don't know.
Yeah, I would have preferred a somewhat different lineup on the inside, but I did enjoy a lot of this very, very much because some of it was so iconic with sort of the origins that we know of the big, supervillains. I could have done without Savannah. And I really could have done without Terror Man because it's not as if Terror Man has again become a big name in DC Comics.
Yes.
So, but yeah, the rest of it I really enjoyed. But we could have swapped out Terror Man for Wonder Woman, and I wouldn't have minded at all.
There you go. Now they did do a second Secret Origins of Supervillains. By the way, Secret Origins Supervillains collection, and Cheetah's in that one. So they I think they realize, like, okay, we got to maybe go back to this. Once again, Aquaman is excluded. Again, just don't even get me started.
Again?
Yeah, they just, you just really got, I will look, I have a whole beef about Shazam, because Shazam being a TV star, he just got, he replaced Aquaman on so many things, so many pieces of the merch. It was Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Shazam, because even though Aquaman was a good, as a member of the Super Friends, in good standing. But anyway, that's what it was. So, okay. I do have a question for you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, in case this is probably something I should have asked you about. I told you I was going to ask you about, but I just thought of it in the moment. And this is something I used to do in the early parts of the show, and I kind of got rid of it over time. As someone who, as you mentioned, you have no real history with the treasuries, right?
Right.
Do you think, and you know, I'm not expecting you to know whether they ever did this or not. I'm just curious about what your answer might be. For DC, at least, let's keep it to DC. What treasury collection would you have liked to have seen? If you were a kid and DC was publishing treasury, or they're doing it now, what would you have liked to have seen? What, either a character or a theme or a storyline? Was there something that you, either as a young reader or maybe now, you would have loved to have seen at like this size?
Huh. That's an interesting question.
Thank you.
I got to think for a second.
Okay. My answer is always Aquaman, but I also know that they were never going to do that, because if they didn't give one to Wonder Woman or The Flash, they're not giving one to Aquaman. I mean, they're just sales-wise, they're not going to do that.
No, they aren't. But I really would have liked to have seen Wonder Woman, and I'm sure that the sales, you know, the sales for the Wonder Woman book were abysmal, because they were for a good chunk of that era. But I really would have liked to have seen one on Wonder Woman, and like I said, that's what I thought I was going to get, but or at least part of it. I am so bitter, but that's all right. Knowing that there's another one out there, I'm going to make Tim go track that one down so I can
have
it. But you know, you and I have talked. You know how much I love Super Friends. I would have, you know, doing one on all of the Super Friends would have been terrific.
That would have been great. Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems amazing that during the run of the TV show,
that
Wonder Woman would not have had enough heft for them to publish a one. I mean, look. I mean, I should be completely accurate. Wonder Woman did appear in the treasuries. She is in Superman versus Wonder Woman, the treasury edition, which is, if you've never read it, read it. They're actually reprinting it as a facsimile edition at a treasury size later on this year. So you can get it. It's marvelous. And she was given not one, but two famous first editions. Wonder Woman number one and Sensation number one. So it wasn't like they completely ignored her. But considering how many great Wonder Woman comics there were to pull from, it does seem absurd that Wonder Woman just never got her own treasury edition to headline. I mean, for pizza, Rudolph got like nine. give Wonder Woman one, for Pete's sakes. So, but well, I'm really glad that you bought this book, and you, it's part of your collection now. That makes me really happy.
It is. No, and I am so glad you asked me to be on to talk about this, because I genuinely enjoyed this. And, you know, I think that we're going to have to start tracking down some of these and keep an eye out for these as we're scouring comic shops. And because these are really cool.
That's good. I'm happy to hear that. Is this the kind of thing that the comic shop, your LCS might have? You know, not necessarily do they have them, but do they have lots of back issues? So these things might show up.
They do. Tim, my husband, works in Grove City, Pennsylvania, and our local comic shop is Bell's Cards and Comics. And Mark, the guy that owns the place, has a terrific a collection of new stuff, plus a lot of back issues. I mean, it's really, in some ways, a perfect comic shop, because it's got a little bit of everything. So,
That's good. That's good to hear. Yeah. All right. Yeah, I said, as you know, I'm a huge fan of these things. They are my all-time favorite format. They're the only comics most of them I still have from a kid. Like, a lot of the copies I have are the ones I bought in the 70s, for Pete's sakes. And again, my cat aside, I've kept him in decent shape. And so some are better than others. And so this collection is a little wonky here in places, but it was something I always wanted to get to. And so, you and I had so much fun talking about Super Friends. So I'm really glad that you were willing to come on and do this with me. So thanks so much, Jen.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm, of course, going to do some listener feedback.
Come take a listen to Campus Comics Cast. Releasing twice a month, Mike, Scott, and Shad get together to talk about anything and everything in the comic book industry. They'll browse the latest previews in the Lunar Next Phase catalogs to highlight the upcoming comics that excite them the most, and they'll even review a few comics. On top of that, you'll get show segments like The First Five, where they discuss the first five appearances of a character or event. And then, of course, is the CLZ Shake, in which one or more of the hosts will shake the CLZ app on their phone and then talk about whichever random comic from their collection pops up. Campus Comics Cast. Find it now on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's me, Sarah Century. You might know me from my podcast, Bitches on Comics, or through the narrative horror podcast, Decoded Horror Channel, and Medusa Mask. So it is that I have returned to talk about comics once more. But it's not just me, gentle listeners. No, indeed. I will be joined by my fellow comic book, I guess we'll say enthusiasts, to chat about our absolute favorite comics of all time. This will include both well-worn classics and hidden gems. Whether you're a longtime reader or a total noob, chances are you'll find something to love. This is Best Issue Ever, hosted by Sarah Century, a mostly weekly comic book podcast that can be found on all major podcast platforms, unless I forgot one. There's kind of a lot of them. You know, podcasts are like comics in that way. Okay, where's the stop recording button?
And now it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on Treasury Cast number 92, Greatest Superhero Team-Ups, with my guest Brett Young. First up is Edo Boznar, who says, great show, Rob and Brett. The only story included in this Treasury that I have read is Namor versus Thing, which I suspect would be my favorite, even if I had read the others. Those Submariner stories drawn by Buscema can't be beat. And yes, I first read them when they were reprinted in the late 70s. As I think Brett noted, the real reason for that rash of reprint books back then was irrelevant to us young fans who were getting to read a ton of great material from Marvel Age's first decade. Otherwise, I agree that calling these stories team-ups is a bit misleading. A few years ago, Marvel got the marketing angle right when they published Marvel's Greatest Superhero Battles, which was my very favorite of those Fireside reprint books. Yeah, I love those books. I have a bunch of them on my shelf here. Someday I keep meaning to like fill out the collection and have the rest of them, but they're kind of pricey, so I have to get them sort of sparingly, but I do love those books. Next up is Movie Matt Sorois, who says, team-ups in the tradition of Ali and Fraser for the Thrilla in Manila, or the Earth and Mars for the War of the Worlds. If it were not for this Treasury edition, I'd have never read a Silver Age issue of Submariner or Silver Surfer. This fight card offers up three perfect matchups and the cosmic-powered Silver Surfer against your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. I think the fix was in on that main event, although Spidey would later face another Herald of Galactus, Fire Lord. The web-slinger didn't have much trouble with him either. I don't know what it is about Kirby's rendition of the Hulk, but I've always loved it. Kirby made him look more intimidating than Trimpy or Buscema, at least in my opinion. The Daredevil versus Cap story is by far my favorite. I always thought it was odd that Daredevil was the bad guy in his own book. The Thing versus Submariner is always a battle of epic proportions. They're even more interesting than the classic Thing versus Hulk bouts. I'm surprised this team-up isn't brought up more often. Thanks for another entertaining episode. Thank you, Matt. Rob McCarthy says, I've gone a bit nuts trying to make rules for when Jack Kirby gave the Hulk chest hair or not. Maybe he was the inker? I know in the uninked Galactus art, Reed Richards has no stubble, which in the script is kind of a big deal. First FF where Kirby draws the Hulk no chest hair. The second time, he looks like Tom Jones drawn by Neil Adams. Didn't they use Greatest Super Battles for Fireside books? As we just mentioned, they absolutely did. Bucky749 says, if this collection had come out in the 90s, it could have been an arcade machine with Fighter Select screen and called Marvel Heroes Fighters Round 1. I would have played the hell out of that game, Bucky. Brian Chufo says, my two fan suggestions on how to get Jason Momoa to do the switch from Aquaman to Namor. One, do a movie version of the Amalgam Universe, oh boy, which merges the MCU with the DCEU. Then when the two universes demingle fly, explain how Jason Momoa is now the new Namor. Overly complicated, but would be a ton of fun. And all the other actors who've appeared in both the franchises can make appearances too. Ben Affleck as Bat-Devil, Michael Keaton as Vulture Bat, Ryan Reynolds as Death Lantern, the Merc with a ring, or maybe throw in Chris Evans as the human Captain Torch of America. When the human Captain Torch throws his mighty flaming shield, flows so nicely in a theme song. Or two, Jason Momoa's agents get him an audition. We'll go with that one. James Williams says the Thing versus Namor battle is actually part of a story arc that's extremely important to Marvel continuity. Silver and Bronze Age Marvel Comics love their superpowered year. Cosmic Cube, Ultimate Nullifier, Soul Jam, Infinity Gauntlet, Aya Agamotto, Darkhold. The Thing Namor battle ends with Namor taking the helmet back with him. In the very next issue, that helmet cracks open and what should be inside but the Serpent Crown. The guy who looks like Commandy who is in the sewers with Daredevil is Kazar. The image is probably from the cover of issue number 13. I'm visually disabled, so I haven't read these issues in at least 20 years. From what I remember, Kazar and his brother, the Plunderer, were in a bunch of issues of Daredevil right after Wally Wood left the title. Yeah, James, I'm shocked that I didn't reason that out because he does look like Kazar, but he also, I don't know. I'm not familiar with those issues of Daredevil, so I was like, why would Daredevil meet Kazar? But of course, it's Marvel. Like, anybody can meet anybody. So yeah, that's absolutely correct. That was Kazar. Siskoid from this very network says, Namor and the Thing properly team up in the next Marvel 2-on-1 installment of FW Team Up, so they don't need to fight. Well, they still might. Martin Gray says, fun episode. I do disagree, though, that in Mindless Slugfest, Marvel is just giving the readers what they really wanted. For me, the big difference between Marvel and DC was the extra soapiness at Marvel. One of the best moments of my childhood was coming across a Daredevil issue in which a whole page was given over to Matt, Karen, and Foggy talking and thinking, and Stan's editorial note proudly says this was the most balloons ever in a single Marvel panel, 22 or something. Why there was never a Marvel's Greatest Superhero Conversations tabloid. Steve Skeets would have had to have been involved in that. Brian Linton says, listening to this episode has led me to completely reevaluate how I viewed myself as a preteen. I never thought of myself as being particularly emo when I was growing up, but then I realized that Daredevil and the Silver Surfer were my first two comic titles that I ever collected on a regular basis. Perhaps I've never truly known myself. Thanks for another excellent episode. I'm sorry, Brian, I didn't mean to throw you into some sort of existential crisis there. This is just a podcast about Treasury Comics. And then finally, Brett Young, of course, from that very episode, says, great show, Rob and me. It was like an FDR fireside chat. There's that word fireside again. With slightly more arm hair discussion. Treasury Cast was the first podcast I ever did, and it was really great to return to the show before it ends. I look forward to the final 8 episodes as the guests increasingly fawn over you. That hasn't happened yet. I really hope it gets going in the later episodes, Brett. Thank you all for the comments. I really do appreciate it. Of course, big, big thanks to Dr. Jennifer Schwartz Levine for coming on. I love talking to Jen, and I'm so thrilled that this show would be the reason that she and her husband might start adding treasuries to their 30,000 plus comic book collection. So yeah, it's just super great to talk to her, and I'm really thrilled that she would do the show with me. So that is going to do it. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of Treasury Cast on our website, brianwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show, although I don't know why you would do that at this point, on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking treasuries on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which has been name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Polier, Brett Young, Mark Balbus, Chuck Dill, and Gord Tolton and David S. Gutierrez for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I really do appreciate it. So that is going to do it. Thanks so much for listening. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
My super breath will extinguish it. Lex, are you all right?
You rat! Your super breath destroyed my lab and blew the gas fumes at me, causing my hair to fall out.
But it was an accident.
Don't lie. You were jealous of my genius. Now you'll never have this kryptonite antidote I invented for you.
And I will use all of my scientific genius to one day destroy you.